Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is Ellie Steele, and tonight I'm going to discuss the Merkaba. We've talked about ascension consciousness, and of course the Agni Yoga series was primarily related to that, and understanding the higher consciousness. But tonight, I've been researching this, the Merkaba, and I found it's absolutely fascinating and something that is beyond me. I wanted to mention a quote from this book. Nothing in this book is true, but it's exactly how things are, by Bob Frisell. And I was going to discuss this tonight, but I found something else that I wanted to get into relating to this. But there's a quote here that I'd like to quote, and it's called, "Ascension is a method of consciously moving from one world to another, taking your body with you. It is different from resurrection, which is consciously moving from one world to another by dying and then reforming your light body on the other side. Excuse me. In the course of its existence, the school..." I'm going to go into a truly remarkable explanation of the Merkaba. And this is from Drunvalo Melchizedek. And we're going to discuss the... This is on a website, actually. I want to discuss there... definition of the Merkaba. And then I want to travel down to the flower of life and the geometrical aspects of it and what we're doing and how it works. And then I want to go into the teaching of spherical breathing using 18 breaths. And I'm going to discuss that tonight with us. We'll go through each step and go from there. So it's called Merkaba. It's also spelled Merkaba, M-E-R-K-A-B-A-H, is the divine light vehicle allegedly used by ascended masters to connect with and reach those in tune with the higher realms. Mer means light, Ka means spirit, and Ba means body. Merkaba means the spirit body, surrounded by counter-rotating fields of light, or wheels within wheels, spirals of energy as in DNA, with the transport which transports spirit and body from one dimension to another. And for those of you who know the sacred geometry, it is a star tetrahedron that is the Merkaba, and which is the vehicle that we travel in. Which is kind of strange, but I'm going to, I think after I read more of this, we'll be a lot more in tune, at least somewhat into understanding what a Merkaba is. And in modern esoteric teaching, it is taught that a Merkaba is an interdimensional vehicle consisting of two equally sized interlocked tetrahedra of light with a common center, or one tetrahedron point up and the other down. And this point symmetric form is called a stella octangula, or a stellated octahedron, which can also be obtained by extending the faces of a regular octahedron until they intersect again. In his books, researcher and physicist Drunvalo Melchizedek described this figure as a star tetrahedron. since it can be viewed as a three-dimensional Star of David by imagining two superimposed star tetrahedrons as counter-rotating along with specific prana or breathing techniques and certain eye movements and mantras. It is taught that one can activate a non-visible saucer-shaped energy field around the human body that is anchored at the base of the spine. Thus we see the flying saucers that are created. Depending on the height of a person during the exercise, this field is about 55 feet across. Once activated, the saucer shape shaped field is capable of carrying one's consciousness directly to higher dimensions. And then it goes into the flower of life, which is a geometrical pattern. And the flower of life is a geometrical figure composed of multiple evenly spaced overlapping circles that are arranged so that they form a flower-like pattern with a six-fold symmetry like a hexagon. And in other words, the center of each circle is on the circumference of six surrounding circles of the same diameter. And the Temple of Osiris, or Abydos, Egypt, contains the oldest to date example. It is carved in granite and may possibly represent the Eye of Ra, a symbol of the authority of the pharaoh. Other examples can be found in Phoenician, Assyrian, Indian, Asian, Middle Eastern, and medieval art. A flower of life pattern can be constructed with a pen, compass, and paper. By creating multiple series of interlinking circles. In some renditions, the rosette, or the unofficial flag of Padania, is a partial version of the flower of life pattern. The flower of life pattern contains the basis of Metatron's cube, and from this pattern, all five of the Platonic solids can be derived. Now, that's getting a little technical for me because I'm not a physicist, nor am I a geometrist or whatever. But I'm going to go on here. Now, this is by Drunvalo Melchizedek, stating that there are 17 plus one breaths, where the first six are for balancing the polarity. Now, these are breathing exercises. This is a breathing exercise that creates the Merkabah. I believe. There are 17 plus one breaths, where the first six are for balancing the polarity, the next seven for proper pranic flow through the entire body. The further breaths are for shifting the consciousness from third to fourth dimension. And finally, the last three breaths is for recreating the rotating Merkabah within and around the body. The last breath is not taught. Once each day, enter into this meditation until the time comes when you are a conscious breather, remembering with each breath your intimate connection with God. First breath. Inhale. Heart. Open your heart and feel love for all life. If you cannot do this, you must at least open to this love as much as is possible for you. This is the most important instruction of all. In other words, inhale, and then open your heart and feel love for all life. If you cannot do this, at least do it as possible, as much as you can. This is the most important instruction of all. The mind. Become aware of the male tetrahedron, the apex facing up to the sun, the point facing to the front for male, and the point for the back for females. Filled with the brilliant white light surrounding your body, visualize it the best you can. If you cannot visualize it, sense or feel it surrounding you. So, become aware of the male tetrahedron, the apex facing up to the sun, the point facing to the front for male, and the point to the back for female. Okay. Body. At the same moment of inhalation, place your hand in the mudra of your thumb. I don't know what a mudra is. Okay, and first finger touching. Remember, lightly touch your fingers and do not allow your fingers to touch each other or any other object. Keep your palms facing up. Now, I'm not going to do this because I'll try it later, but I'm just reading what they're asking me to do in order to get to that level. Plus, since I have a cold, it's really difficult to breathe properly. It says breathe. At this moment, with empty lungs, begin to breathe in a complete breathe through your nostrils. Except at certain places which will be described. Simply put breath from your stomach first, then your diaphragm, and finally your chest. Do this in one movement and not three parts. The exhale is completed either by holding the chest firm and relaxing the stomach, slowly releasing the air, or by holding the stomach firm and relaxing the chest. The most important aspect is that this breathing must be rhythmic. Begin by using 7 seconds in the 7 seconds out, 7 seconds in, 7 seconds out. But as you get familiar with the air, my spot here, I'm sorry. The most important aspect is that this breathing must be rhythmic. Begin by using 7 seconds in and 7 seconds out. But as you get familiar with the meditation, find your own rhythm. The following instructions for a complete yogic breathe are from the Hindu Yogi Science of Breath by Yogi Rama Sharak. Perhaps this description will be helpful. I don't know if I want to continue this. This is rather long, involved, and a breathing exercise. What I'd rather do, if you don't mind, difficult to understand this thing here, but I'm going to go back to the Merkaba, right? To the understanding of the Merkaba rather than the breath. If you can achieve this breath exercise, the very special breath will not be taught here, which is the 18th breath. You must receive it from your higher self. It is the breath that will take you through the speed of light into the fourth dimension. You will disappear from this world and reappear in another one that will be your new home for a while. This is not the end, but the beginning of an ever-expanding consciousness, returning you home to your Father. Fascinating. The word Merkaba, or Merkava, Hebrew chariot, or general meaning to ride an animal in a chariot, is used in the Bible, which is Ezekiel, states it in Ezekiel, to refer to the throne chariot of God, the four-wheeled vehicle driven by four cherubim, each of which has four wings and four faces, face of a man, a lion, an ox, and an eagle, and four means time in alchemy. And so number four means time in alchemy. In medieval Judaism, the beginning of the book of Ezekiel was regarded as the most mystical passage in the Bible, and his study was discouraged, except by mature individuals with an extensive grounding in the study of traditional Jewish texts. Jewish biblical commentaries emphasize the imagery of the Merkabah is not meant to be taken literally. Rather, the chariot and its accompanying angels are analogies for the various ways that God reveals himself in this world. Maimonides, in his 13 Principles of Faith, emphasizes that God is not limited to any particular form, as his prophecy might seem to imply. Chasidic philosophy and Kabbalah explain at length what each aspect of this vision represents in this world, and how they in no way imply that God is made up of these forms. The danger of understanding these passages as literal descriptions of God's messianic image likely accounts for the opposition among Torah scholars toward learning this topic without the proper initiation. Jews customarily read the biblical passage concerning the Merkabah in their synagogues every year on the holiday of Shavuot. History. The earliest Merkabah speculations were exegetical, whatever that means, expositions of the prophetic visions of God in the heavens and the divine retinue of angels, hosts, and heavenly creatures surrounding God. The earliest evidence suggests that Merkabah homiletics did not give rise to ascent experiences. As one rabbinic sage states, many have expounded upon the Merkabah without ever seeing it. The Talmudic interdictions concerning Merkabah speculation are numerous and widely held. Discussions concerning the Merkabah were limited to only the most worthy sages, and admonitory legends are preserved about the dangers of overzealous speculation concerning the Merkabah. The sages, these rabbis were deeply involved in Merkabah speculation. Rabbi Akiva and his temporary Rabbi Ishmael ben Elijah was most often the protagonists of later Merkabah ascent literature. Beyond the rabbinic community, Jewish apocalyptists also engaged in visionary speculation concerning the divine realm and the divine creatures, which are remarkably similar to the rabbinic material. A small number of texts unearthed at Qumran indicate that the Dead Sea community also engaged in Merkabah speculation. Recently uncovered Jewish mystical texts also evidence a deep affinity with the rabbinic Merkabah homilies. Recently, considerable scholarly attention has been paid to the use of Merkabah themes in early Jewish Christian circles. The Merkabah homilies eventually consisted of detailed descriptions of multiple layered heavens, usually seven in number, often guarded over by angels and encircled by flames and lightning. The highest heaven contained seven palaces, and in the innermost palace resides a supreme divine image, God's glory, or an angelic image, seated on a throne, surrounded by awesome hosts who sing God's praise. When these images were combined with an actual mystical experimental motif of individual ascent, paradoxically called descent in most texts, the union is not precisely known. By inference, contemporary historians of Jewish mysticism usually date this development to the 3rd century. Again, there is a significant dispute among historians over whether these ascent and unitive themes were the result of some foreign, usually Gnostic, influence or a natural progression of religious dynamics within rabbinic Judaism. The biblical Merkabah in depth. According to the verses in Ezekiel, and its attendant commentaries. The analogy of the Merkaba image consists of a chariot made of many angels being driven by the likeness of a man. Four angels form the basic structure of the chariot. These angels are called the Chayat, C-H-A-Y-O-T. The bodies of the Chayat are like that of a human being, but each of them had four faces corresponding to the four directions the chariot can go, north, east, south, and west. The faces are that of a man, a lion, an ox, later changed to a child or a cherub, and an eagle. Since there are four angels, and each has four faces, there are a total of 16 faces. Each chariot angel also has four wings. Two of these wings spread across the length of the chariot and connected with the wings of the angel on the other side. This created a sort of box of wings that formed the perimeter of the chariot. With the remaining two wings, each angel covered its own body. Below, but not attached to the feet of the Chayat angels, are other angels that are shaped like wheels. These wheel angels, which are described as a wheel inside of a wheel, are called ophenim, wheels, cycles, or ways. These wheels are not directly under the chariot, but are nearby and along its perimeter, much like the wheels of a car. The angel with the face of the man is always on the east side and looks up at the likeness of a man that drives the chariot. The likeness of a man sits on a throne made of sapphire. Now, I'm going to reference something that an image that I've seen actually in a British museum in New Haven, Connecticut. It's in the works of Blake, the mystic Blake. He drew. Blake descended into visions. He was prophetic. He was a prophet of sorts. And he would descend, and I say descend, he would transcend into these remarkable visions that he would have. He actually spoke with Satan, and he spoke with demons, and he spoke with angels, and he saw hell, and he saw heaven, and he saw all of these imaginable, miraculous and amazing visions that he had. And he, of course, Blake was a great poet as well. But his prophetic poems and his drawings. He was a remarkable artist. But his color drawings were. One that I saw was of the Merkaba. I didn't know it was a Merkaba at the time, but now that I'm this, I saw it. And he had this incredible man figure, male man, God. I believe it was God within this chariot of fire, an angel, and it had. This whole thing, and it was a scene, and it was what he had seen, what he saw, and he saw this entering Earth, kind of Earth or Middle Earth, because it wasn't. I recall the scene, and it wasn't really heaven. It was more of a place, another place, and it had stones, and it had mountains, and it had so it was like Earth. But here was this flaming chariot driven by an elderly man, muscular man, because most of Blake's men, if you will, or figures were well drawn and muscular. Definition was quite as male figures, this was a god, like a Greek god, that he had seen. But it was all ablaze, and he was riding in this orange fired chariot, and was exactly what this was. And I didn't realize it then, but that was obviously a Merkaba, or the Merkaba, a Merkaba, and or the chariot, or chayot. But if you ever get a chance to look up any of Blake's work, especially his artwork and his visions that he saw, were absolutely amazing. And if you read any of his apocalyptic works or visionary poetry, just blow you away. It was a phenomenal individual. But anyway, let me get back here to this. But I wanted to mention that the works of Blake were quite remarkable, especially his drawings and his poetry and his grasp of this. You know, most people thought he was out of his mind, but he wasn't. I mean, what he saw was remarkable visions that he had. There was another gentleman too at that time. A little later, was Swedenborg. If anybody has ever followed Swedenborg, but he also would. He would become interdimensional, whereby he could actually go into hell. He actually could descend into hell, or descend into heaven, or descend, or into that another dimension, and graphically identify or describe what was going on there, and the demons, if you will, or angels, or whatever the conflict or whatever the whatever he was observing. And his works are remarkable. I mean, if you've ever read any of his works, it's Swedenborg, and he was a remarkable visionary as well. But anyway, let me go on. Forgive me for getting sidetracked here, but if you can remember some of those names, look under Blake, Blake, and of course Swedenborg, and you will be amazed at what you find. And the Bible later makes mention of a third type of angel found in the Merkaba called the Seraphim, or burning angels. These angels appear like flashes of fire continuously ascending and descending. These seraphim angels function somewhat like pistons in that they powered the movement of the chariot. The hierarchy of these angels, the seraphim, are the highest, that is closest to God, followed by the chayot, which is followed by the ophanin. Spell that, which is O-P-H-A-N-N-I-M, Ophanin. The chariot is in a constant state of motion, and the energy behind the movement runs according to this hierarchy. Now, the movement of the Ophanin is controlled by the chariot, while the movement of the chariot is controlled by the seraphim, and the movement of the angels of the chariot, are controlled by the likeness of a man on the throne, which could be God, or could be us, actually. It could very well be us, in that we are, are those that, of us, who can create this Merkaba, and, understand its power, and ascend and descend to different dimensions. a chassidic, C-H-A-S-S-I-D-I-C explanation, a chassidic explanation. A chassidic philosophy explains that Merkabah is a multi-layered analogy that offers insight into the nature of man, the ecosystem, the world, and teaches us how to become better people. The four Chayat angels represent the basic archetypes that God used to create the current nature of the world. Ophanim, which means ways, are the ways of these archetypes combined to create actual entities that exist in the world. For instance, in the basic element of the world, the lion represents fire, ox represents earth, the eagle represents the wind, and man represents the water. However, in practice, everything in the world is some combination of all four, and the particular combination of each element that each element that exists in each thing are its particular ophanim or ways. In another example, the four Chayat represent spring, summer, winter, and fall. These four types of weather are the archetypical forms. The ophanim, which means the ways, would be the combination of weather and that exists on a particular day, which may be a winter-like day within the summer or a summer-like day within the winter or whatever. The man on the throne represents God, who is controlling everything that goes on in the world and how all of the archetypes he set up should interact. The man on the throne, however, can only drive when the four angels connect their wings. This means that God will not be revealed to us by looking at all four elements, for instance, as separate and independent entities. However, when one looks at the way that earth, wind, fire, and water, which all oppose each other, are able to work together and coexist in complete harmony in the world, this shows that there is really a higher power, God, telling these elements how to act. This very lesson carries over to explain how the four basic groups of animals and the four basic archetypical philosophies and personalities reveal a higher godly source when one is able to read between the lines and see how these opposing forces can and do interact in harmony. A person should strive to be like a Merkabah, that is to say, he should realize all the different qualities, talents, and inclinations he has, or his angels. They may seem to contradict, but when one directs his life to a higher goal, such as doing God's will, the man on the chair driving the chariot, he will see how they all can work together and even complement each other. Ultimately, we should strive to realize how all of the forces in the world, though they may seem to conflict, can unite when one knows how to use them all to fulfill a higher purpose, namely to serve God. Key texts. The ascent texts are extant in four principal works, all redacted well after the third, but certainly before the 9th century. The key texts are Hekalot Zutarti, or the Lesser Palaces, which details an ascent of Rabbi Akiva. Hekalot Rabati, the Greater Palaces, which details an ascent of Rabbi Ishmael. Masha Merkaba, the account of the chariot, a collection of hymns recited by the descenders and heard during their ascent. And four, Sefer Hekalot, the Books of Palaces, also known as Book 3 of Enoch. and which recounts an ascent and divine transformation of the biblical figure Enoch into the Arcanian Metatron, as related by Rabbi Ishmael. A fifth work provides a detailed description of the Creator as seen by the descenders at the climax of their ascent. And this work, preserved in various forms, is called Shiur. I'm going to repeat this. I'm going to spell it SHI'UR. QOMAH. And it means the measurement of the body. And is rooted in the mystical exegesis. That's a familiar word to me, so pardon the pronunciation. EXEGESIS, exegesis of the Song of Songs, a book reputedly venerated by Rabbi Akiva. The literal message of the work was repulsive to those who maintained God's incorporeality. Miam Onides, who died in 1204, wrote that the book should be erased and all mention of its existence deleted. While throughout the era of Merkaba mysticism, the problem of creation was not of paramount importance. The treatise of the Book of Creation represents an attempt at cosmogony. From within a Merkaba milieu. This text was probably composed during the 7th century, and evidences influence of Neoplatonism, Pythagoreanism, and Stoicism. It features a linguistic theory of creation in which God creates the universe by combining the 22 letters of the Hebrew alphabet along with emanations presented by the 10 numerals, or Sefirot, which is S-E-F-I-R-O-T. Whew, went through that one. anyway.
Destroyed the memory of man.
And so all the technological advancements made up until that point, which were great and vast, were suddenly gone overnight. I mean, the Earth had just destroyed the planet, basically, any civilization, by flood and volcanoes and every unimaginable thing. And the whole entire continent of Atlantis sunk, was destroyed. And all of its technology with it. And then what happened was is that this Atlantean, who was by the name of Thoth, who later, who was also known in Greek mythology as Hermes, the messenger, came back to Earth a number of different times, all right, and to teach mankind. And what I'm going to do is, Thoth left the Emerald Tablets, and they were preserved in Egypt, and later found. But let me give you the history of Thoth, which is the first. And I think it's very important that we go through this. And I also wanted to go through the story of creation, the 12 pyramids of Thoth, the story of creation, music, and meditation. And it goes into Hermes and Atlantis. And we talk about so many things. I mean, it's just beyond really. So many important things. Symbols and everything. But tonight, before we still get time, I'd like to at least get through. Let me read the preface of this so we can understand what we're reading. And then I'll see if I can read. I know it's pretty long. But I'll see if I can get through to the first tablet, which is the history of Thoth. The Emerald Tablets of Thoth, the Atlantean, is the preface. The history of the tablets, translated in the following pages, is strange and beyond belief of modern scientists. Their antiquity is stupendous, dating back some 36,000 years B.C. The writer is Thoth, T-H-O-T-H, an Atlantean priest king, who founded a colony in ancient Egypt after the sinking of the mother country. He was the builder of the Great Pyramid of Giza, erroneously attributed to Cheops. It is in it he acknowledged his knowledge, he incorporated his knowledge of the ancient wisdom, and also secreted records and instruments of ancient Atlantis in these pyramids, the pyramid of Cheops, or Giza, rather. For some 16,000 years, he ruled the ancient race of Egypt from approximately 52,000 BC to 36 BC. At that time, the ancient barbarous race among which he and his followers had settled had been raised to a high degree of civilization. Thoth was an immortal, that is, he had conquered death, passing only when he willed, and even then not through death. His vast wisdom made him ruler over the various Atlantean colonies, including the ones in South and Central America. When the time came for him to leave Egypt, he erected the Great Pyramid over the entrance of the Great Halls of Amenti, and placed in its records and appointed guards for his secrets from among the highest of his people. In later times, the descendants of these guards became the pyramid priests, by which Thoth was deified as the god of wisdom, the recorder, by those in the age of darkness which followed his passing. In legend, the halls of Amenti became the underworld, the halls of the gods, where the souls passed after death for judgment. During later ages, the ego of Thoth passed into the bodies of men in the manner described in the tablets. As such, he incarnated three times, in his last being known as Hermes, the thrice-born. In this incarnation, he left the writings known to modern occultists as the Emerald Tablets, a latter and far lesser exposition of the ancient mysteries. The tablets translated in this work are 10, which were left in the Great Pyramid in the custody of the pyramid priests. The 10 are divided into 13 parts for the sake of convenience. The last two are so great and far-reaching in their import that all present is for that at present it is forbidden to release them to the world at large. However, in those contained herein are secrets which will prove of inestimable value to the serious student. They should be read not once but 100 times, for only thus can the true meaning be revealed. And a casual reading will give glimpses of beauty, but more intensive study will open avenues of wisdom in the seeker. And again, I'm going to ask you, before we finish the show tonight, to Google up Emerald Tablets of Thoth, T-H-O-T-H. You can even go to Emerald Tablets and it'll come to it. And it'll probably bring you to Crystal Links, which is, and then you can just tap on or click on the Emerald Tablets, and you can read them for yourself. They are remarkable. But this will give you a better idea. I know I'm jumping around tonight, and I'm going here and there and everywhere, but I wanted to talk about the Merkaba, and I think we covered that quite well and what it is. But, you know, again, what I want to do is I want to include where are these references go. I think it's important to make these references and possibly come back and read these references for you. Because I've read the Emerald Tablets, and you know they're remarkable. I've read them a number of times, and they continue to reveal things to me. But as I read more and more, you know, things tend to gel. They tend to all come together, and they all tend to create this rock of knowledge, if you will, that I rest my foundation on, you know, as of metaphysics and understanding where we're going, basically, or where we've been and where we're going. And as an individual and as a race and as a species, and trying to understand this concept of the advancement of consciousness, or the ascension of consciousness into a fourth dimensional creational state, it's a mind-blowing concept, but yet it's so well thought out, and for decades, for millennium, you know, and more, people have known this. I mean, millenniums. Thousands and thousands and thousands of years, people have studied this and know it and have used it and have made it work, and it's carried down to today, and it's called the Merkaba, and it's called the Emerald Tablets, and it's called sacred geometry, and it's called all of these remarkable sciences and philosophies and histories, all right? All work together to bring to the forefront a strong understanding, or a better understanding, of what we're to do. In other words, if we believe that we are going to ascend in our consciousness to the fourth dimension, where all things become ours, become manifested, at that point we'll manifest everything that we desire, everything. An entire population or civilization will want for nothing. We'll want for nothing, and we will be a part of the universal community. Right now, we're a separate community. We're Earthlings, okay, if you will. But soon, and sooner than you think, we will become universal citizens. We will have ascended this third dimensional life that we live in, this hard life, this hard physical existence that we endure. There are hunger and thirst and disease and cruelty and murder and mayhem and so on. That won't exist on the fourth dimension. All of that will be left behind, because in order to ascend, you must first rid yourself and those, you must rid yourself and your mind and your soul of all malice toward mankind, all malice toward anyone, and just have love, and love of one another, love of community, love of it, so that once you arrive into that fourth dimensional state, then you will only manifest good things, positive things, love, peace, joy, happiness. All of these things will be manifested within that cycle, within that fourth dimension. Whereas death, destruction, disease, corruption, lies, hate, you know, all the terrible things, pollution, everything that we suffer here will no longer exist there. We'll be done with it. We'll be done with it. And no one who ascends will want those kind of negative aspects in their mind. They won't want it. They won't want any of this stuff. If they do, and they are possessed by these things, by their worldly needs or their whatever, then they'll stay here. They won't move on. They'll move on some other time. But for now, in this moment, 2012, if you will, when all time and space are ended, it's suspended, it no longer exists, you no longer have to wait for anything. You no longer have to drive anywhere to get somewhere. You no longer have to, because this can be done instantaneously. This will be done at a thought, all right, which you can transport your physical body and your physical and spiritual self into a third dimensional, into a fourth dimension, into a place where there's, imagine, no disease, no illness, no corruption, no crime, no hatred, no wars, no murder, no mayhem. Everything and everyone has exactly what they want and is perfectly content, physically and emotionally and spiritually content within that field and within that dimension. And then we will be able to rise further, the fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, eventually within our evolutionary cycle. But once we get beyond this third dimension, we are citizens of the universe. We are citizens then. We're accepted citizens. We're accepted by the alien beings. We're accepted by the angelic hordes. We're expected by God and by all of his creation at that point as a higher intelligence, as a higher being, as a race of people that have transcended the trappings of the third dimension, and that's a wonderful thing, and that's what we must be looking ahead to, and as individuals. And this doesn't mock religions, and it doesn't shove in the face anything that's unusual. All it does is it takes it to the finite understanding of what it is, which is ascension consciousness, and everything that's involved with that, all right, is a positive aspect of the entire population of Earth and mankind. Is just that we will be transported against our will. Actually, we won't even know that it's happening. We won't until we wake up and realize we're already there. All right. many people are. In fact, 8,000 to 10,000 people right now in this world are operating within a Christ consciousness. And they are out there, and they are working hard to help others achieve that state of consciousness as well. And hopefully in some way I'm bringing it to you tonight. But it was through John Velo Melchizedek that I understood parts of it, but it was truly through George Dixon, okay, who brought me, who made me aware of these things, okay? And we discussed it on our Friday night show, which we'll be discussing tomorrow night with George. So what I'm going to recommend is that you, is some background reading. As you go to the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, the Atlantean, all right? And then, if you want, you can go to what we were discussing tonight, which was the website here. It's called Merkabah. If you just go into Merkabah, that's all I did. Merkaba. And it'll bring you to the, I believe this is the Crystal Links segment. And you're going to see this article by John Velo Melchizedek, which is the 18 breaths. And then you'll go on and you'll see an explanation of the sacred geometry and pictures of the Merkabah and history of the Merkabah and so on and so forth. But And please, I also don't forget, you may want to look up Blake, and you may also want to look up, Crystal Links, crystallinks.com, all right, /Merkabah, okay, and that'll bring you right to where we are right now. And also, Crystal Links has in it the Emerald Tablets, so you can go to that. And in the last few minutes, what I'm going to do is just give you something else here to read, and that is the second. I want you to, I mentioned Blake, and that's of course William Blake, but they have him as a simple, I'm looking him up here in Wikipedia so that you realize it was, they just state that he's a English poet, painter, and printmaker. Well, that's true, but that's only half of what he was, and, you know, less than half of what he was. And if you study him, be amazed. Blake was influenced by the ideals and ambitions of the French American religions, as well as such thinkers as Jacob Boehm and Emanuel Swedenborg, which is who I mentioned. Blake's work is difficult to classify, which is true, but if you will look at some of his incredible, incredible pictures, you can't deny his genius. You just can't deny his genius. And in the visions that he had, absolutely amazing. And there's some very, very famous pictures that you probably recognize. One is God's creation of the earth, called Ancient of Days, where you have God within this fireball with a huge golden compass in the days that he created the earth, how he created the universe. And, go to Wikipedia if you want to find out more about him. Absolutely amazing. They've got a pretty good background on him, and William Blake. And then I wanted to again, Swedenborg is another man that you might want to consider listening to. Emanuel Swedenborg, Swetenborg. And I'll leave you with that. He talks about the Merkaba himself, how he saw it, how he saw it done. He was a man of science as well. So I'll leave you at that. And I want to thank everybody tonight. Another show's up. But wish you all a good evening and hope you join us next week, rather tomorrow night, when we speak to George Dixon. And good night, and thank you for joining us.